situation as the country that unilaterally withdrew from the comprehensive agreement on the Iran nuclear issue and caused the current situation. The U.S. should demonstrate political sincerity, uphold the spirit of mutual respect, participate in dialogue and consultation, and at the same time stop its wrong practice of threats of force and exerting maximum pressure.
He added that China will continue to maintain communications with all relevant parties, actively promote peace and dialogue, and push for a diplomatic solution. Meanwhile, Moscow has expressed support for the upcoming talks between the U.S. and Iran, with Kremlin spokesperson Dmitry Peskov emphasizing such discussions could help de-escalate tensions surrounding Iran.
At an emergency meeting with Israeli Premier Benjamin Netanyahu, United States President Donald Trump shockingly claimed that Washington is about to hold direct talks with Tehran for the first time since 2018. Trump did not provide additional details, and just last week, only indirect talks were approved by Tehran.
We're having direct talks with Iran, and they've started. It'll go on Saturday. We have a very big meeting, and we'll see what can happen. And I think everybody agrees that doing a deal would be preferable to doing the obvious. And the obvious is not something that I want to be involved with.
That came after Trump openly threatened to bomb Iran, which was dismissed as not very probable by Iran leader Ayatollah Sayed Ali Khamenei. Trump is infamous for exaggerations, bluster, and untrustworthiness, as in his first term he failed to honor the 2015 JCPOA agreement on Iran's nuclear energy program. Trump's remarks seem to chagrin a scandal-ridden Netanyahu, who is repeatedly accused of trying to push Trump to expand the Israeli-U.S. genocide in Gaza into a disastrous all-out regional war.
To be manipulated, to allow or participate in a war on Iran and destabilize the entire region. So we are hopeful that we can continue to push him because he himself expressed the desire and hope that he will be the president of peace. So on those bases, we urged him to hold Benjamin Netanyahu accountable, not to appease him and not to give him everything he wants.
With his predecessor, Joe Biden, launching war in Ukraine and immediately joining the Israeli genocide in Gaza, many believed Trump's campaign promises to avoid more endless, unwinnable wars.
President Trump has the opportunity to establish peace in the region that is based on justice and not further any escalation or start any wars. He told the world that he wants to end wars. He doesn't want to start ones. So he can do that. He has the ability, and I hope that he has the will. If he does otherwise, he will just destroy his own legacy by his own hands.
Tehran continues to stress that it approves of bilateral relations on, quote, equal footing, that it seeks peaceful relations and peaceful resolutions to current conflicts, and complained to the United Nations Security Council about Trump's, quote, reckless and belligerent and illegal threats. Ramin Mazahiri, Washington, D.C.
Now, China's avowed retaliation against the U.S. in response to Donald Trump's threat of additional tariffs. The Chinese Ministry of Commerce said it will fight to the end following Trump's threat of an additional 50% tariff on Chinese imports. It also condemned Trump's tariffs as unilateral bullying. China has emphasized the countermeasures taken are aimed at protecting its sovereignty and security while maintaining the normal international trade order. The remarks come as Trump's sweeping tariffs have shaken markets globally, with major indices experiencing the sharpest decline in years. Political analyst Qingdu Shou has weighed in on the U.S. president's threat of additional tariffs on China, calling it imperial bullying.
I think from the Chinese point of view, first of all, China does not have any intention to have an economic warfare with Washington. But for every country that is truly sovereign, that is truly independent, you have to defend your own sovereignty. You defend your interests by legitimate means, because that's what you need to do for your people, for your nation, statehood. If you have a problem such as Washington, they have, you need to talk to like your trading partners to solve such a problem, to express your concern and find a way to solve the problem, a legitimate way under the international trading system. So far, obviously, Washington is not doing that. They are bullying basically every economy, every country. They are threatening with more tariffs on the goods from other countries. So this is a practice of a unilateral and imperial bullying, of other countries. I think that's unacceptable for a lot of countries, including China. So I think China is resolute, saying that, you know, we have to defend our interests. If there are more tariffs upon the Chinese good, we will take appropriate measures to do, our round to protect our interests.
And saying with Trump's tariff war, the U.S. president has responded to the European Union's zero-for-zero tariff offer by demanding the bloc buy over $350 billion worth of energy from Washington to get the tariff relief. Trump made the comments during a press conference at the White House with visiting Israeli Premier. He added the EU's offer of zero tariffs is just not enough to cover the bloc's $350 billion trade deficit with the U.S. EU offered a two-way zero tariff for American and EU products after Trump slapped 20% tariffs on the bloc and another 10% on all U.S. trading partners. Now, the Israeli regime presses ahead with the genocidal onslaught on Gaza, killing more civilians in the devastated territory. In the latest developments, an early morning attack targeted a home, killing at least six Palestinians and injuring several others in Beit Lahia in northern Gaza. Over a dozen people were also killed and many wounded in similar attacks on residential buildings in central Gaza. And other parts of the Palestinian territory, including Rafah to the south, were also targeted by multiple air and artillery attacks, causing dozens of fatalities. Also, a journalist succumbed to wounds he sustained in a Monday attack on a camp of media workers in the southern city of Khan Yunis. That attack left another journalist killed and a number of others wounded. The total number of deaths now since October of 2023 stands at over 50,750, with nearly 116,000 Palestinians wounded. The heads of six UN agencies have issued a grave warning on the situation in Gaza. They're calling for immediate resumption of the ceasefire there amid a deepening humanitarian crisis. Agencies warned of severe aid shortages and hunger since Israel resumed its all-out aggression on the 18th of March. They said for over a month, no commercial or humanitarian supplies have entered Gaza after Israel blocked entry of all aid trucks. Agencies noted more than 2.1 million people are trapped, bombed and starved again, while food, medicine, fuel, and other supplies are piling up behind Gaza's closed crossings. Agencies added at least 1,000 children were killed or injured during the first week of Israel's genocide resumption, which is the highest one-week child death toll now in the past year. Meanwhile, huge crowds of people gathered in the Syrian capital, Damascus, as part of a global campaign to demand an end to Israel's genocidal war on Gaza. Protesters highlighted the targeting of journalists and warned of broader ambitions by Israel to expand its territorial control.
We came here to demand an end to the genocide in Gaza. What's happening there is beyond reason, and no one with a conscience can accept it. People across the world are angry and heartbroken over the atrocities. The Israeli occupation seeks to dominate the Levant, but it will never succeed. They've tried to invade both Dara and Gaza and failed.
Today, we are in Damascus as part of the global campaign to stop the genocide that has been ongoing for over a year and a half against the Palestinian people in Gaza. More than 53,000 have been killed, thousands injured, and countless remain missing, possibly still buried beneath the rubble as a result of this systematic extermination. We must also highlight the targeting of journalists. The world must pay attention to what is happening in the West Bank. People must understand that Israel's goal is to establish a state from the river to the river, not just over Palestine or part of Syrian land.
We are here today with pride and dignity to voice our outrage and sorrow over what is happening to our people in Gaza. What is taking place is rejected by Muslims, by Palestinians, and by all of humanity, we came to release the intense emotions stirred by the horrific scenes of destruction, bombardment, and death in Gaza.
Israel Forza pressed ahead with violent raids on Palestinian towns and cities across the occupied West Bank. The occupation forces stormed Nablus and abducted several Palestinians, and in a separate incident, the Israeli forces demolished a home in the village west of Bethlehem. The Palestinian Prisoners Media Office says at least 38 people have been abducted in various areas of the occupied West Bank as occupation forces continue widespread military operations. Violent raids by Israeli soldiers and settlers have significantly increased across the occupied territories since the Gaza genocide began. Meanwhile, the occupied territory saw a general strike Monday in protest at the ongoing Gaza genocide.
The streets of Palestine fell silent on Monday. In a unified response, Palestinian factions announced a general strike in all Palestinian territories and refugee camps abroad. The move comes in protest at Israel's nonstop assault on Gaza. The factions describe the strike as a collective message to the international community, a demand to halt what they call a systematic genocide. Since October 7, 2023, Israel's military campaign has left over 165,000 Palestinians killed or wounded. The vast majority of them are women and children.
It's crucial for Palestinians to take to the streets. This catastrophe affects all of us, from Gaza to the northern West Bank, with attacks happening everywhere. If we expect the world to act, we must lead the way.
Shops, schools, public institutions, and private businesses closed their doors, echoing the grief and the resistance of the people under siege.
The horrors we're witnessing are unbearable. These crimes demand daily action, not seasonal outrage. The attacks are escalating. Nothing is spared. The crime is massive, and silence is even worse.
From historic uprisings to citywide shutdowns, the general strike remains a powerful tool of resistance.
Today's strike carries key messages: rejecting the genocide, calling on Palestinians everywhere to support Gaza, boycotting Israeli goods, and urging the world to end its silence. Today the war's in Palestine. Tomorrow it will extend to other countries. This must stop.
It's time for the people to have a voice and take action. Today marks the beginning, and we will continue until the war on Gaza and the northern West Bank end.
With refugee camps across Lebanon, Syria, and Jordan, and other supporting countries joining in, the voice of the streets is powerful, and the pain of Gaza has reached unbearable levels.
The empty streets and stores here sends a clear message. One is to Gaza that the pain enduring by Palestinians is the same. The other message is for the world that the time has come for a firmer move to stop Israeli crimes. Naqa Ahmed, Ramallah, Occupied West Bank.
The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has condemned the recent wave of arrests of anti-Israel activists and protesters by the Palestinian Authority in the occupied West Bank. Now, in a statement, Hamas accused the PA of attempting to suppress popular movements that support Gaza. Groups said detaining Palestinians for participating in marches and activities in solidarity with Gazans serves the goals of the Israeli occupying entity. Hamas says such a measure is a stab in the back for all Palestinians. Hamas's statement comes after the PA arrested a number of pro-Palestine demonstrators during a general strike held in the West Bank on Monday. Israel continues pounding southern Lebanon as well, killing and injuring more civilians despite a ceasefire with the country. Lebanon's health ministry said three people were killed and two injured following the Israeli regime's strikes on Monday. According to the ministry's statement, one civilian was killed in the town of Tabin near the border. Now, Israel claims it targeted a Hezbollah artillery commander in the town. Also, an Israeli drone strike on Dardara Road left two Syrians killed. Ministry said two others were injured in strikes in southern Lebanon. Thousands of people have taken to the streets of the southern Lebanese city of Sidon to show solidarity with Palestinians in Gaza and condemn ongoing U.S.-Israeli genocide in the besieged territory.
We stand in solidarity with our people in Gaza and Palestine in general, and God willing, from Egypt to Palestine and the entire Islamic world, We are rallying against the brutal Zionist enemy, the brutal Zionist enemy that will not spare anyone, neither woman, nor old men, nor young men, nor stone, in this war. God willing, victory is ours. God willing.
We are rallying to say that we are all Gaza, all our children, who are my children, and all of us stand with Gaza. We are Palestinians. From the diaspora camps, we have the right to return. And God willing, soon, we will return to Palestine, which is ours.
The demonstrators waving Hamas and Hezbollah flags chanted slogans against Israel, while civil defense members carried representations of children's bodies. They also held signs reading Save Gaza and Stop the Hunger. That's a wrap for your latest, everyone. Thanks for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything. We should learn and appreciate what it gives us.
واقعیت زندگی
and try to apply them to our daily lives.
چجوری ممکنه؟
How is it possible?
از راه قرآن
by means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من این قدم آخر نیست
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step brothers not the last one
هو الذی ارسل رسوله بالهدى ودین
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth that he may make it prevail over all religions though the polytheists should be averse.
تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد موسیقی خاصی دارد روش خاصی دارد
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones. But it's not enough.
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن. دوری از قرآن.
Muslims' major problem is losing touch with the Quran. Quran, Quran.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
For today, you will listen to the English translation of a part of the text of the message delivered by Imam Sayyid Ali Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the occasion of Nowruz, the start of the Iranian New Year on March 20th, 2025. First, in the face of an event like the loss of the president, the massive turnout of the people for his funeral procession, the slogans they chanted, and the high morale they exhibited showed that although this was a serious tragedy, it wasn't able to make the Iranian people feel weakened. Furthermore, they were able to promptly hold elections. We must thank God for this. Moreover, during the recent events of the past months, when many of our brothers in Lebanon, our brothers of religion, and our Lebanese brothers faced difficulties, the Iranian nation gave its support with open hearts. This event that took place in this regard, that is, the overwhelming flood of aid from the people for their Lebanese and Palestinian brothers, stands as one of the enduring, unforgettable events in our country's history. The gold that the Iranian women and ladies generously parted with and contributed to this cause, and the assistance given by our people and our men, are matters of great significance. They reflect the strength of the nation's wills and its unwavering resolve. This spirit, this warmth, this readiness, and these spiritual strengths are assets for the future of the country and for the enduring life of our dear Iran. These sets, God willing, will be used to the fullest by the country, and may Almighty God continue to bestow His blessings upon the nation. Last year, we introduced the slogan, Surge in the Production Through People's Participation, which was essential for the country, and in a sense, it was vital. However, the various events that unfolded in the year 1403 prevented this slogan from being fully realized. Of course, significant efforts were made by both the government and the people, as well as by the private sector, investors, and entrepreneurs. They were able to accomplish good things. However, the work that was done fell short of expectations. So this year, too, our main issue remains the economy. Thus, my expectations from our esteemed government, respected officials, and our dear people once again centers around economic issues.
Allah, I want to thank you. That you've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
On today's special edition of The Conversation, I will be speaking to Mark Thompson of Relevance for Justice. Given the reaction to judgment by a High Court judge sitting as a coroner into the unlawful killings of four IRA volunteers in February 1992. Mark will be here to discuss the judgment and, of course, give further context into the killings. Mark, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you for having me in, Sean.
So, first of all, Mark, can you give us a bit of context into exactly what happened in February 1992?
Well, four IRA volunteers were shot in a hail of bullets. Almost 600 bullets were fired at them in Clonoe Car Park, Chapel, in the Cole Island area, after an IRA operation where they had attacked an empty RUC station. And what transpired in that gunfire, initially the RUC and the British government had said that there was a firefight between four IRA volunteers and a specialist military unit that had been lying in wait on them arriving at the Chapel Car Park. What has transpired now is that there was never a firefight. The IRA had mounted an attack, a propaganda attack, on an empty RUC station, and they'd essentially shot concrete. So when they arrived at the Chapel Car Park to dismantle and leave, the SAS were waiting on them, and they killed them. Yesterday, a judge sitting as a coroner, a High Court judge in Belfast, had declared the killings effectively to be unlawful. All four of the men were shot, two whilst running away, and then shot as they lay incapacitated, executed on the ground, and two others were executed. There was an opportunity to make safe and effective arrest under the rule of law and to bring people before courts to face due process. And instead, the UK government, as they have done in many of these so-called set-piece, shoot-the-kill incidents, ambushes, they've determined to kill people rather than to proceed with due process. So all the parameters and all the issues around protection of life and safeguarding and safe and effective arrest were dispensed with, and this was basically a murder operation. One of the senior officers, a colonel known as Colonel A, called it the kill zone. And what has transpired is that these men were under intensive surveillance night and day for weeks and days leading into this attack. They posed no threat when they reached the car park, and then they were ambushed in a hail, as I say, of 600 bullets. Now, there's been huge reaction to this from politicians and former British soldiers saying that the judge doesn't know what he's talking about, that this is 30-odd years later, he hasn't examined the facts. Well, the judge examined in great detail the pathology, the ballistics, the forensics. There were experts that looked at the scenes. The scene was recreated visually in every context. The scene was visited. He relied on a lot of the statements made initially at the time by all of these soldiers. And he has determined that it was never effectively and properly investigated. Indeed, he has said it was covered up. And he has said that the men were unlawfully killed. And the reaction, the broader reaction to that, has been one of violence and vilification of these families. These families and their victims of the conflict, these families have had to endure 33 years to wait on an inquest and a verdict that was delivered yesterday. And throughout that period, they had been harassed and harangued, been to court scores of times. We attended courts in Cookstown and Dungannon preliminary hearings. We've attended courts in Belfast to support the families. The families have led an admirable battle and done society, I would say, a great service in exposing what has happened. And many victims will see themselves in the context of this judgment yesterday. There aren't many days for victims of state violence to receive such a judgment, and particularly in these circumstances. And it's only but right. The rule of law has been applied, and somebody with a clean eye has now looking at this issue and examined all of the facts. It's not the RUC cover-up that happened, that's been addressed. Are these effective murders? That's exactly what they are. And so in some senses, when the family's been on that journey for 33-odd years, when they were going to courts, they were stopped and harassed. They were taken out of cars. And I think of one of the deceased, Sean O'Farrell, of his brother Austin, who had severe disabilities, who was in a wheelchair, severely disabled, and would have travelled in a special constructed vehicle to carry him to court. How he was oftentimes stopped by the British Army and the RUC at the side of the road, taken out of his wheelchair on one occasion. And the vile commentary and derogatory comments made about his brother and what happened to them, equally the other family members. So they've had to endure all of this, they've had to battle themselves, and very admirably, they've had this result. And now we see the vitriol again in the bile and the hate in social media and from certain politicians and public figures. People like Johnny Mercer, who's defended what's happened in Iraq, what's happened in Afghanistan, who's defended the British Army when they've killed children, civilians, men, women, priests, and now again trying to defend the indefensible, as they often do, and which he's made a career out of. We hear other politicians criticising this judge. This judge examined the facts in minute detail over a considerable period of time and made a verdict and a finding based on the evidence. And the comments that have been made about him are potentially libelous. But that said, you know, we're as an organisation also cognizant of all victims and survivors, of all the hurts by all of the actors of the conflict, all sides. And when I say all sides, I'm not talking about the kind of term all sides here, which is Republican and Loyalist. I also include the British state and everything that they've been involved in, because they were at the heart of this, and the British government were at the heart of these killings. And other families will take comfort from this judgment. In one sense, it's a bittersweet moment, because they see themselves within this judgment of what happened to their loved ones too. And there needs to be reflection in this society for the people that are involved in the hate and the vitriol and the bile and the derogatory comments made about these four young men and their families and the outcome of this case. Because if we're a society that's going to move beyond conflict, we need to deal with justice, we need to deal with truth, and we need to deal with uncomfortable conversations around those issues. And yesterday a judge declared, based on the evidence, that these men were effectively murdered. Now the families will, with their lawyers, consider all of that. And in any other circumstance, if it was anyone else, there'd be calls for prosecutions. And that's probably where this probably needs to go to, because these soldiers were engaged in murder. And so in the context of all of this as well, we have the Legacy Act. And the purpose of the Legacy Act, when you listen to these veterans that don't want to be investigated and their cheerleaders, the consequence is if we had the Legacy Act in place and these inquests had not concluded, that verdict would have been covered up by a Secretary of State in the Intelligence Services, because under the legislation, they would not publish anything that was damning to themselves, and they would use clauses like national security and not in the public interest to proceed and publish that. That's why open justice is important. That's why the rule of law is important. And that's why proper, effective investigation, not only into this incident that took place, that was completely unnecessary and completely avoidable, also into the failure to properly investigate it by the RUC at the time. And so that's the broader context in which this is framed. And here, this is a story about an argument about what the IRA done, and calls, look at the IRA and look what they done. Yes, the IRA harmed people, and I acknowledge that. But I want people to reciprocate that the families of IRA people killed in the conflict and killed unlawfully, and as in this incident, in the shoot to kill, summary executions, and the use of lethal force that was casually done throughout the conflict, to reflect on those families and their views and their feelings and their rights to truth, their rights to justice, and that the truth, what happened to their relatives, is laid bare too. Because these four young men, had they been arrested and processed, and if they were sentenced and convicted, they would have been out within a few years because of the peace process. And there'd be men now in their mid-40s with their own families grown around them. And they've been denied that. And these families have fought for truth and justice, supported by ourselves, tooth and nail. And we're glad to stand beside them and do that. But along that journey, they've lost parents and siblings that haven't saw this moment. And that's a tragedy in itself. So before people want to hurl abuse and use social media and attack these families and vilify them at the time which they did when the men were killed, they need to step back and think about that. And they need to think about the hurt and the pain that the families of Republicans endured equally as much as anyone else endured. And if somebody reflects back, we did a report in 15 years ago into these killings based on the evidence that we had access to and the disclosure of documents. And some international students that worked for us, legal students doing their masters, two of them have now moved on. One's a lawyer in Germany and the other was a prosecutor, and she is now a judge dealing with international war crimes. They assisted in that report and that research. And we determined that we would name that report Ambush, Assassination, and Impunity. because that's what the evidence showed us. And the judges saw that evidence, and he said more or less the same thing.
And just on the vitriolic responses we have seen, some coming from leading unionist politicians, given the relationship between democratic unionists, and I say that in inverted commas, with loyalist paramilitaries, with the British state, and all the violence that came with that, do you think there's a sense of some cognitive dissonance with unionist politicians? Why do you think that there's a kind of a different reaction to, you know, how we historically look at the past as Republicans as to unionist view that history?
Well, there is some serious self-reflection, I think, that needs to take place, because there are double standards and hypocrisy. I'm quite comfortable to sit here and say that Republicans harmed people during the conflict and visited hurt and death on people who are left behind, families like the families of IRA, dead people as well killed during the conflict. And so we have to humanize this as well. You know, the tears and the hurt and the pain of the parents of an IRA volunteer and their family, it's no different to the pain and the hurt and the tears of a loyalist paramilitary, a British soldier, an RUC person, or the vast majority of civilians who were killed in the conflict. You know, we need to humanize this as well. And so this sense of defending the indefensible and demonizing people and certain individuals, whilst you stand with loyalist paramilitaries on one hand, that you walk in the political talks with them on the other hand, that they assist you in your elections, or you defend them, you know, all of that. You know, we need to get to a place where we can hear each other and we can understand. And the application of human rights and the rule of law and the foundation of justice and democratic principles is how we move away from conflict and build a new society. And if you don't want to listen to those institutions because they tell you through open justice within a British court what you don't want to hear, well then I fear for these people and their contribution that they can make in moving us out into new spheres of transitional justice, transitional society, and going forward. And I reflect back on the report that we did. We put the front picture on the report. And at the time, the family of Barry O'Donnell and Sean O'Farrell and Peter Clancy and Daniel Vincent, you know, they tried to bury their loved ones. And the photograph shows the small church in the graveyard where the mourners attempt to go in with the coffins. And it's lined with several hundred police officers in full riot gear and armed. And that was to stop a flag being put on a coffin. And yet the dignity of those relatives in those moments is inspiring. It's a testament to human resilience, everything that they've endured. And yet again, with the verdict, people don't want to listen to that, neither want to vilify the judge. And I really do think, in terms of the legacy of the past, between this Legacy Act, where the state want to hide its sins and use a smothering blanket of national security to prevent any exposure of what they were at, to stop judges in open courts finding the truth and revealing the truth. We've all of that to consider, and people need to reflect. A British Secretary of State needs to reflect. Politicians need to reflect. Society needs to reflect. You know, what messages are we sending to our children and our grandchildren? What hope are we giving for the future? These are important constructs and principles and matters that we need to grapple with. And we did, and we got to a place, and then the British government pulled the rug from under it in terms of the Stormont House Agreement, and they went down this route of amnesty for their own and their agents, and to cover themselves and to prevent the narrative of the truth about what they were involved in. And so we're in this phase where they're trying to shut down the courts because of these types of judgments. And we have this commitment by a Labour administration in opposition to repeal and replace. And now we see they're in the driving seat. And it seems about MI5 is driving this agenda with the security apparatus and the security kind of former security personnel. And the people need to really stand back and have an honest conversation about the hurt that was caused, the damage that's caused, the failure to lance those boils and deal with them in a constructive way in terms of the truths about the past. No more foundations of lies. Let's have the truth. Yesterday was a good day. People will find that difficult and challenging, but it was. And it goes to the heart of the nature, causes, and extent of the conflict that four young men in 1992 joined the IRA. They, for them, thought that was the only option. Now we've transformed society. Now we need to deal with the legacy of the past. And now we need to grapple with all of those issues in a real and meaningful way. Not through the burr pit or the pigsty of some of the debate shows and radios and TVs or the megaphone stuff that's full of vilification on social media. Deal with it constructively, positively as we can. Face into the hurt, face into the pain, and address it and recover and heal. And truth and justice and accountability are fundamental to those matters in terms of obtaining them.
I fully agree, Mark. I want to thank you for coming in today, because it's important that we have these conversations, and it's something that we will be focusing on a lot more on the conversation. So thanks again for coming in.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the lantern.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Dear brother and sister, salam. So, welcome to a new story. Yes, this is another episode of Lantern, and we have a new story entitled More Generous Than Hatem. Hatem Tai was questioned, "Have you come across anyone more generous than yourself?" He replied, "Yes, I have." He was asked where. He said, "I had been traveling in the desert when I came across a tent. Inside it there was an old lady while behind the tent a goat lay tied. When the old lady saw me, she approached me and held the reins of my horse so that I could dismount. A little later, her son arrived and was immensely pleased to have me as their guest. The old lady said to him, 'Commence the preparations for to entertain our guest. Go and slaughter the goat and prepare some food.' The son said, 'First I shall go and collect some firewood.' But the old lady said, 'Going to the desert and bringing the firewood shall consume a lot of time, due to which our guest would have to remain hungry for long, and this would be contrary to social etiquette.' So the son, breaking the only two lances that he possessed, slaughtered the goat, prepared the food, and presented it before me. When I investigated about their condition, I realized that the goat had been their only possession, and despite this, they had slaughtered it for me. I said to the old lady, 'Do you recognize me?' When she replied in the negative, I said, 'I am Hatem Tai. You must come with me to my tribe so that I can entertain you and shower you with gifts and presents.' The old lady said, 'Neither do we seek any reward from our guests, nor do we sell break for money. and she refused to accept anything from me. Witnessing this generosity, I realized that they were far more generous and munificent than me. Now we'll listen to the explanation of Sister Musavi. She speaks about important points of this story.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله. Dear audience, welcome to a new episode of Lantern from IRIB English Radio. This is Zainab Musavi, and what we do in this program is to listen to certain religious stories and then try to talk about the themes and lessons that we can take out of these stories in our daily lives as Muslim. Well, the story we just listened to is about generosity and its most famous practitioner was Hatam al-Ta'i. Generosity, you know, holds a paramount place in Islamic ethics, serving as a manifestation of faith and vital expression of compassion. This principle is beautifully illustrated in the life of figures like Hatam al-Ta'i, who is often celebrated in both Islamic and Arabic literature for his unparalleled generosity. Hatam al-Ta'i's life mirrors this principle, as his generosity was not limited to personal relationships, but extended to the broader social fabric of his time. Moreover, the Holy Book of Quran encourages believers to give in a variety of circumstances. In Surah Al-Insan, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala states, أَعُوذُ بِاللَّهِ مِنَ الشَّيْطَانِ الرَّجِيمِ وَيُطْعِمُونَ الطَّعَامَ عَلَى حُبِّهِ مِسْكِينًا وَيَتِيمًا وَأَسِيرًا إِنَّمَا نُطْعِمُكُمْ لِوَجْهِ اللَّهِ لَا نُرِيدُ مِنْكُمْ جَزَاءً وَلَا شُكُورًا. And they give food in spite of love for it to the needy, the orphan, and the captive, saying, we feed you only for the face of Allah. We wish not from you reward or gratitude. Surah Al-Insan, verses number 8 and 9. So this selfless giving, done without expectation of reward, is a hallmark of true generosity. Hatam al-Ta'i lived this principle fully, often sacrificing his own comforts for the sake of others. His legacy serves as a reminder of the transformative power of generosity, not just for the recipient, but for the giver as well. Let's go for a short break and we will be back in no time.
The Lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story which indicates a moral aspect of our life.
Okay, well, generosity also emphasizes the importance of intention, or what we call in our Islamic terms, niyyah. The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam stated, actions are judged by intentions and every person will get the reward according to their intention. This principle is crucial in understanding that the act of giving is not purely about the material aspect. It is deeply rooted in one's spiritual intentions. Hatam al-Ta'i, with his unwavering dedication to helping others, exemplified this ideal. His actions were not motivated by the desire for fame or recognition, but stemmed from a sincere commitment to uplift those around him. The concept of generosity extends beyond mere financial contributions. It encompasses a holistic approach to kindness and compassion. This is reflected in the teachings of the Imams alayhim as-salam, who emphasized that true generosity involves not only giving material resources, but also offering emotional support, wisdom, and time to those in need. The story of Imam Ali alayhi salam serves as a poignant example of this multifaceted generosity. You know, he was known for his willingness to assist the poor, provide counsel to the distressed, and stand up for justice, often prioritizing the needs of others over his own. This illustrates that generosity is a reflection of one's character and a manifestation of divine love and mercy. It encourages individuals to cultivate a spirit of selflessness and to engage in acts of service that contribute to the welfare of the community. So, fostering a sense of unity and solidarity among all members of society. In conclusion, generosity is a core value within Islam, profoundly articulated through the teachings of the Holy Book of Quran and Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam. Figures like Hatim al-Ta'i serve as timeless examples of this virtue, showcasing how true generosity transcends the mere act of giving. It embodies love, compassion, and a deep sense of social responsibility. The teachings of Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam reinforce that generosity is not just an act but a way of being, an essential characteristic of a true believer. As Muslims, embodying this spirit of generosity not only strengthens our individual faith but also fosters a culture of compassion and mutual support within our community. Finally, the legacy of Hatim al-Ta'i and the teachings of the Islam remind us that acts of generosity can transform lives and create a more just and caring society. Okay, well, dear listeners, it seems that our time for this episode has come to its end. I really hope that you have enjoyed listening to this episode. And until another one, I bid you farewell and may Allah protect you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Dear brother and sister, thank you very much for your company. This is the end of this episode of Lantern. Until a new story, fi aman Allah.
From Sana'a. Welcome to your window into the latest developments out of Sana'a, Yemen. I am Yusuf Mari. And in this program, we will be discussing all of the latest events unfolding in the country, from the U.S. airstrikes that has lasted for 4 weeks to Yemen's retaliatory attacks targeting USS Harry Truman aircraft carrier in the Red Sea, along with other U.S. military manifestations, including warships and also supply ships. Also, the Yemeni army has also targeted military sites in occupied Palestine. We will be discussing this and much more. Joining me today is Dr. Ali Muhammad Al-Sabri. He is a professor at the Sana'a University, and he is also a political expert. Doctor, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. Thank you.
I'd like to start by first asking you, you know, it's been 4 weeks since Trump launched this military campaign. His declared goals were to decimate who he calls the Houthi military capability. Has he achieved any of the goals that he first declared at the beginning of these military operations?
No, nothing has been achieved because what
Trump has, of course, announced something, you know, ambiguous, and that is not clear to the people, the aim that he is fighting the Yemeni citizens. Now, what we see just in various areas and governorates and the air raids by the U.S. air jets, that they are just affecting the situation of the Yemenis. So even the embargo or the siege or the blockade, it's not against any party in the country. It is against the citizens. It is the civilians of this country. So the goal that he wants to, as maybe called that, to affect the Houthis, we haven't seen anything in that, because the Houthis who called, they are part of the country. They are also citizens. And the capabilities that he is wishing to get, he will not get anything. Why? Because the Ansarillah and the Houthis, they are in support for the Palestinian people in Gaza Strip and all Palestine. So Trump has claimed earlier that he would be a peaceful man, he would spread peace, and he does not like wars. So now he's lying again. He changed everything. He starts now with the customs tariffs, so he creating wars throughout the world for nothing. So it's not only Yemen. Now the Yemenis, they are so resilient and they are steadfast against any aggression, and they are with the Palestinians. They are supporting those innocent women and children in Palestine. So why the United States is just supporting Israel? And it has now recently sent the THAAD and the Patriot, also defense equipment for Israel. And they do not see that the Palestinians without food, without electricity, without water. So they're creating starvation in Gaza. And he's supporting those killers and murderers. And in Yemen, he's doing the same, because the Yemenis are also civilians and they do not go to the United States to fight it. Nobody is fighting any country. This is a peaceful country. We are calling for peace. And we support our brothers because we have one religion. And we have, it is a feeling of like a humanity. This is a humanitarian feeling. So they cut the humanitarian aid and they stopped even the ceasefire in Palestine. And they resumed now the fighting for almost now a month and so. And in Yemen, they are losing everything, because their reputation is nothing. They are fighting a country which is so far, it's not affecting or making any dangers or risks to the United States. And this is again what we see in this country, that we have the heroes of the Yemeni armed forces. They are clashing in the sea, in the Red Sea, and because it's not only America. They claimed and they announced from the beginning that they are fighting and making the stop for the vessels that go to Israel, because they want to participate with their brothers in Palestine, at least to say what we have to do to prevent the goods and also whatever they have through the sea to Israel and to the occupied land. Now, this is the Yemeni, at least now, slogan. And this is what we want to do to defend the Yemenis and to defend the Palestinians, because we are in one boat. So the other Arab countries these days, all right, we have some Arab countries now, they make demonstrations. Algeria now showed also demonstrations in the streets. Libya has also demonstrations. Also in Jordan and different Arab countries, even in Mauritania. So the Arab people, they are feeling that this war is against them all, because it's against Islam. Oh, they want to get rid of all the Islam, not only from Palestine, but from the Arab world and the Islam countries.
Of course they know, especially in recent years, I think it's become very clear that out of the Muslim world, they know that Israel, that the Israeli regime is hell-bent on destroying their countries.
Yes.
I think people know that. And I think not just Muslims know this. I think even the larger Western audience, they know who the good side and the bad side in this conflict. One side is committing genocide, the other side is trying to stop the genocide from happening. I think the large portion or the majority of the world, they know who's on the righteous side and who's trying to spread chaos and massacre.
Yes,
they know, but the reason why I bring this up is because I don't think it's just enough to have